Now we are going overseas. You are listening to a podcast from the Historical Society Listoria, Bremen, Germany, in cooperation with volunteers in the United States. Act 5, In the Light of Lady Liberty's Torch, How Immigrants Experienced Their Arrival on Ellis Island. Welcome to the lobby of the United States on the Island of Tears and American Dreams.
In 1892, Ellis Island is opened as a collection point for immigrants outside the New York City area because Castle Garden has been overloaded. The first immigrant to be registered is a 15-year-old Irish woman. Annie Moore receives a gold coin worth $10 as welcome money. In the German Immigration Center in Bremerhaven, the individual stations that third-class passengers have to pass through on Ellis Island are restructured.
For poor immigrants like Annie Moore, entering Ellis Island might be the start of a new, a better life. But there are also Europeans traveling to the US with a return ticket, early carefree tourists, even groups on guided round trips, keeping diaries and taking photos.
In 1893, Baedeker launched an American guide, and the German tour operator Karl Stang offers the first package tour to the United States. The fast steamer Saale carries 57 wealthy travelers to America, mostly men, but also some women, from Bremerhaven to New York. One of the tourists, 26-year-old Belgian William Davignon, has his camera with him. The photos from his album Un voyage aux États-Unis, die Suite 93, can be admired on the website of the Leibniz Institute for Regional Geography. There is Stang's party, as the group calls itself, on board the Saale and at Niagara Falls, and views from New York and San Francisco, Indians on the track, and Opium Cave in Chinatown, national parks, and of course the World's Fair in Chicago.
The German writer Heinrich Lemke seems to know Ellis Island and Castle Garden like the back of his hand. In 1883, he published the book Souvenir to the Atlantic Ocean for Instruction and Entertainment for Travelers to America. And in 1896, his book on North America has just been published in Leipzig, Canada, the Country and Its People, a guidebook and geographical handbook containing a description of Canada with a special reference to its economic conditions as well as its settlement and colonization. In it, he also described the arrival at the Port of New York. Since 1883, the superintendent of the pier has been Edmund Badenhausen, a captain from Melzungen in Hesse, of whom we have already heard. Heinrich Lemke describes the arrival of an overseas ship.
As soon as the ship approaches the port and lands at Staten Island, the quarantine doctor of the state of New York appears on board to subject all tween-deck passengers to an examination of their state of health, regardless of the ship's doctor's certificate. This is done in such a way that all passengers on deck pass in front of the doctor, and he tries to judge according to the appearance of the individual persons whether someone shows symptoms of illness. In such a case, the whole ship, if the disease is contagious, is placed in quarantine. From Staten Island, the ship reaches its landing site, called the Pier, in New York or Hoboken, opposite to the former cosmopolitan city In an hour's journey, the cabin passengers leave the ship here along with all their luggage.
And while the cabin passengers may follow Lemke's advice and take a room in the hotel Hamburger Bremer House at the foot of the third alley in Hoboken after customs control, the passengers from the cheaper seats still have one stop ahead of them.
The tween deck passengers and their luggage are transported by the large steamer and small river vessels, specially prepared for the transport of the arrivals now called immigrants in the territory of the New World, directly to Castle Garden, the state landing depot for immigrants in New York. This large immigration depot is a model institution of its own kind.
And so, the 15-year-old Christoph Tebbins from East Frisia experiences his arrival in 1866.
New York, Castle Garden. With my extensive knowledge of the English language, I had nothing more important to do than to translate this name into German for my dear parents and all those who wanted to hear it. Castle, Schloss, Garden, Garten. No, that's Schlossgarten. That's right, said my Uncle Gerhard, but my father smiled. Of course, the garden, consisting of a few lawns with some undergrowth, seemed inviting enough to us after the long sea voyage. But the building, the castle, an old, dilapidated-looking wooden round castle, but very spacious.
Heinrich Lemke is familiar with the formalities that have to be completed in the United States even before arrival.
In order to facilitate control, the steamship companies must keep manifestos which answer 20 different questions concerning immigrants. These certificates shall state the age, sex, marital status, nationality, previous place of residence, and destination of the immigrants, whether the person concerned can read and write, whether he is in possession of a transit rail ticket to his American destination, whether he has paid for the passage from his own resources or at whose expense he has traveled, whether he is in possession of money, whether and to which relatives he travels, whether he is healthy or afflicted with physical infirmities, and so on. The manifesto must be sworn by the captain and the physician of the ship in question before the United States consul abroad before commencing the voyage and shall form the basis for the examination of immigrants at the U.S. landing depot.
Those who have passed all the checks in Castle Garden wait in the inner rotunda of the building until they continue. An official reads out the names of those to whom a letter or money has been sent, or who are picked up by relatives or acquaintances against receipt.
This prevents newcomers, especially women and young girls, from falling into bad hands.
And that's how the Tebbins family experiences it in 1866.
The many immigrants ran back and forth, not knowing what to do first. We settled down on our luggage. The heads of families or individuals were now interrogated in turn by the customs officers and officials of the German society about their belongings and where they came from and where they were going. They were then given the best possible advice, and one by one they departed. Some were picked up by relatives, but most were taken in tow by hotel agents known as runners in this country. These were very rough fellows, and it was not easy to get out of their hands if they wanted to maneuver someone to their respective inn.
In Castle Garden, the newcomers are still courted by the hotel agents decades later. Who should they go with? Who is reputable? Heinrich Lemke has his own suggestions for his readership.
For all those who want to stay in New York for a few more days, there is an opportunity to make a suitable choice among the agents of concessioned inns who suddenly storm into the rotunda under the reputation of boarding houses. I have visited all the immigrant logis houses in New York in the interest of immigrants and can highly recommend the following lodging houses.
And German names follow. These are the times when New York hotels are still called Hotel Grootli or Wurttembergerhof, Hammer's Hotel, Emmengrottenhaus or Stuttgarterhof, and you still have to pay $1 to $1.50 for an overnight stay. And as far as other costs are concerned,
tipping is not customary in the United States of America and Canada, and is therefore never given or requested. The transport of people and luggage from Castle Garden to the station, the weighing of luggage, etc., is also free of charge under the control of the responsible officer.
And in 1897, the 53-year-old Heinrich Lemke came to Ellis Island to report on the innovations for the gazebo. He has taken the free steamboat that connects Manhattan with Ellis Island as a ferry and is allowed to roam freely on the 7.5-acre island. Immigration Commissioner Dr. Joseph Senner, a Democrat, receives him, and Lemke is suitably impressed. The main building is 160 meters long and 50 meters wide. The basement houses the baggage magazine. The second floor houses the registration hall and the offices. There is also a hospital, a machine house, and various sheds.
At first, I positioned myself in the large registration hall in such a way that I could best overlook the invasion of immigrants from the Hamburg mail steamer Pennsylvania. Next to me were some American women dressed in silk and velvet, who might have a special interest in the visit to Ellis Island. In one room we see a German family that forms almost an entire family tree. There are 15 people. That's what counts. There, in a corner, we see a very young, pretty girl, an orphan, scarcely 16 years old, who made the journey across the ocean alone. Here we see a group of emaciated men who visibly drove misery out of their homeland. There, a mother seeks to satisfy the hunger of a crying infant. Here, an expert on the country gives his ship's friends, all young, downy-bearded men, a lecture on the American art of getting rich, and now even the confusion of languages, the many dialects of this international society.
Everyone has to line up at one of the four registration slots. The documents are examined, including the ship's manifests, and questions are asked. The whole thing takes 3 to 7 hours. Those who have successfully survived are picked up by relatives or acquaintances or wait at the landing depot until the train heads west.
What is one on one?
Asked some immigration officers who sit on high chairs and have interpreters by their side.
Do you have a job? Do you have any diseases? Do you have relatives or acquaintances with whom you will be staying? Have you ever been to the United States? Have you ever been in prison or an almshouse? What race do you belong? Are you a polygamist? Do you have any money with you? At least $50? What do you want in the US? Do you clean stairs from top to bottom or from bottom to top? Are you an anarchist? Are you planning to assassinate the President of the United States of America?
Illiterate, sick, and criminals, or those who could be, are rejected. Parents have to decide whether to send their sick child back on their own. As soon as they climb the 50 steps to the registration room, the new arrivals are observed by doctors. Does anyone have heart problems or perhaps a stiff leg? 2 out of 100 people are rejected, about 100 to 120 each day. Over the course of six decades, there are about 250,000 who are not allowed to enter the country for medical, political, or other reasons. 300 desperate people are said to have taken their own lives. Heinrich Lemke has the impression that the rejected people who are waiting for their deportation lack nothing.
The immigrants declared ineligible for landing by this board will receive extremely humane treatment on Ellis Island until they are transported back to Europe. The food for these poor is strong, tasty, and plentiful. The bedrooms and washrooms are of the most meticulous cleanliness.
In 1897, Heinrich Lemke repeated almost verbatim at the beginning of his report on Ellis Island what he had reported in May 1886 in the Husumer Wochenblatt at the check-in in Castle Garden about the arrival of 1,200 women, men, and children from the tween deck of the Rugia. Whether fantasy was also involved can no longer be verified, but let's let him tell.
At a given bell signal, the door to the registration hall suddenly opened, and now a swarm of several hundred immigrants moved into the giant hall. In terms of nationality, most of them were Germans, but there were also many Austrians, Hungarians, Russians, Swiss, Swedes, Norwegians, and Danes. In single file, with boxes, crates, and bundles, old junk and ancestral household goods, often packed with infants, they passed by, subjected to criticism by doctors, and were then distributed into rooms separated by wire bars for 30 people each. A peculiar sight, this whole scenery. The younger ones, especially the girls, have dressed themselves up festively. The dear vanity of the fair youth allows them no other way than to set foot on the soil of the new world. The older generation of immigrants, however, follows a different principle. It's just good enough for the trip seems to be the guiding idea here.
Whoever can answer the questions to the satisfaction of the officials is allowed to go ashore. Those who do not are subjected to a special interrogation in a separate department and are brought before the Board of Special Inquiry, a court of inquiry consisting of four inspectors and a secretary. In 1886 alone, 43,645 people had to face the Board of Special Inquiry. Anyone who fails has to wait in the landing depot for a steamship company to depart and is brought back to Europe at the expense of the shipping company, like an unwanted postal package, acceptance refused. In 1886, 2,374 people were sent back, mainly destitute people from Italy, Hungary, Austria, Russia, England, and Ireland. Many of them can neither read nor write. For Heinrich Lemke, the interrogations of this Board of Special Inquiry were the most interesting spectacle that could be enjoyed on Ellis Island, if you are not interrogated yourself.
Righteous people who are oppressed by misery through no fault of their own, failed existences brought down by their own fault, fate juxtaposes here. A Russian Jew who claims to have been in America for 2 years is subjected to a harsh interrogation. He speaks a little broken English. The chairman asks him,
"What were you in America?"
"Taylor."
"Have you never been begging here?"
The word begging is unknown to the Russian, and unable to answer, he turns to the interpreter for assistance.
"Thou shalt say whether you hast scrounged when thou hast been in America."
"God the righteous shall preserve me when I have scrounged."
And since a fellow countryman known to him, resident in New York, has arrived who undertakes to the Immigration Commission to guarantee that the newcomer will not be a burden on the public care of the poor, he is allowed to land. Another Russian, a young farmer, is not as happy as his predecessor. He is a healthy, strong young man who is able to work hard, but has only 15 cents of cash with him, so that, according to the laws of the country, this young, faithful blood must be transported back to Russia. If it is not possible to find someone in the next few days who will engage the young man and take him with him.
The whole thing resembles a play, a melodrama, with or without a happy ending.
An Italian woman, a widow with three small children and a 19-year-old son, explains to the board that although they are all destitute, her son is working and wants to be their breadwinner. The members of the board look at each other in disbelief and shake their heads. But the young man knows how to make such a favorable impression on the board through his unvarnished clarification of the facts that, especially since compatriots also vouch for the immigrants, they do not deny the family entry into the new world.
It goes on.
Now an elderly German who is in his 50s and must have been shipwrecked in his life comes forward and confesses that he is impoverished and that his family, wife and children are still in Germany. A German-American family he knows wants to find him work. The wife of a German innkeeper from New York is already stepping forward.
We know the man and want to employ him as a dishwasher and servant in our dining room.
This man was also granted landing. How will he fare in his new position? Again, a completely impoverished man, a shoemaker from Russia, is called before the Board of Special Inquiry. He says that he has a brother in America who has been living in Brooklyn for a long time. But the brother hasn't shown up. Back to Russia, if your brother doesn't come to guarantee you, is the Board of Special Inquiry's decision. Dejected, the poor man staggers to a bench and sits down on it, but only for a moment. Suddenly, he hears a well-known voice calling his name. It is the brother who has just come. An outcry when they both see and recognize each other. They hug and tears of joy run from their cheeks. Everyone and every etiquette are forgotten. The spectators, even the members of the board, are moved. Thankfully, the brother is able to give the board sufficient guarantee that the immigrant will not be a burden on the public care of the poor, and both then stroll away with great pleasure.
A few decades later, Jewish Europeans and other victims of Nazi persecution have no chance of seeking safety in the United States without a guarantee. Quotas and internal instructions to the responsible officials ensure that the number is much lower than originally planned. Many hope in vain for a visa, such as Betty Barr from Oberglin and her son Alfred, who wanted to flee from Amsterdam to the United States and were murdered by the Nazis. Betty's siblings, Bertha and Siegmund Sondheim, her sister-in-law Yechin, her nieces Adi and Rita, and her nephew Herbert, the Sterns from Niederohmen and the Sterns from Dietz Anderlan, can be saved. After the Kristallnacht pogrom of 1938, relatives vouched for them and set money as security for the next few years. Siegmund Sondheim is so weakened as a result of his imprisonment in the Dachau concentration camp that he first has to go to hospital after arriving in New York. The family is still allowed to enter the country. Back in 1897, Heinrich Lemke also visited the hospital on the island. 350 children will be born here over the decades. 3,500 patients will die, and the contagiously ill will be separated from their relatives.
Soon I was standing in front of the chief physician of the hospital, invited by him to take a seat with a courteous please. As I learned from him, the number of sick people in the last year amounted to 1,717 persons. That means approximately 0.5% of all immigrants, whose total number in 1896 was 263,709 persons. Of the sick, 40 people died, but 10 children also saw the light of day here. The total number of catering days was 14,503. A tour of the rooms of the hospital made me see everywhere the most meticulous cleanliness and the excellent care that the sick find here.
And he goes to the Ellis Island Bureau of Statistics to do some research.
Of the 263,709 immigrants who landed, 66,445 were from Italy, Austria-Hungary 52,085, Russia 39,859, England 38,226, Germany 24,230, Sweden 60,379, Norway 6,599, Denmark 2,820, Portugal 2,476, Holland 1,465, Switzerland 2,253, Turkey 4,252. The German immigrants brought with them the largest percentage of money and made up the smallest percentage among the illiterates.
And what about the financing of Ellis Island?
Since the shipping companies that land immigrants in the United States have to pay a bounty of $1 for each, which goes into the government's immigrant fund, this tax is not only sufficient to cover all the expenses for the maintenance of all institutions, but also to generate a considerable surplus every year.
As a visitor, Heinrich Lemke can leave the island whenever he pleases. He's not the only one looking for something.
Fully satisfied with the impressions gained to Ellis Island, I turned to go to the ferry. On the way there, I met the elegant American women again, who had previously watched the spectacle with me in the registration room. A young, pretty girl, a German, stood in front of them. The father and mother of a young immigrant woman, apparently belonging to the peasantry, next to her.
Well, you'll leave your daughter to me as a maid? She's supposed to have a good time. I'll pay her $14 a month.
Mother, what do you think?
It should be fine with me.
Tears ran softly from her cheek, and the daughter, she agreed. After all, she had come to America to earn lots and lots of money. A few moments later, and the young girl will drive away with the elegant ladies while her parents will rush west on the railroad train to settle there as farmers on the prairie. Will it be a breakup forever?
An outcry tears him from his thoughts.
I looked and saw an old mother weeping and sobbing on the neck of a handsome young man. The situation was easily explained. It was a young German who had immigrated several years ago and who, having achieved prosperity through work, had now had his elderly parents join him. Here, on Ellis Island, they saw each other for the first time in many years. The joy of the reunion was too great for the mother. She had to rejoice and weep at the breast of her son at the same time.
It's evening, and he's taking the ferry to Manhattan.
When I landed at Battery Park in New York, I saw all sorts of suspicious figures, peasants, catchers, who, like a pack, follow the ignorant immigrant at every turn during his appearance from Ellis Island and try to rob them of their belongings. True gallowbirds.
Heinrich Lemke tries to put himself in the shoes of the people he met on Ellis Island.
What a painful experience such an immigrant often has to go through before he has completely found his way to the new world. The beginning is usually very difficult. The memories of youth rise in the distance to ideal height. Soon the poor man finds himself in that state of illness that in earlier times, when travel was still limited to a few, was attributed to the Swiss as hereditary. Homesickness has broken out in full force in him, and only sooner or later gives way to the one who finds success or happiness in the new world.
You have been listening to the podcast, Now We Go Overseas, a free production from the Historical Society, La Storia Bremen, with volunteers from the United States. This was part 5, In the Light of Lady Liberty's Torch, How Immigrants Experienced Their Arrival on Ellis Island. Written by and final technical editing by Monica Felsing. English version directed by Susan Eldridge.
Recordings by Susan Eldridge, Justus Rand, Monika Felsing, and some of the readers. Theme, We Go Overseas, intro and extra melody, Burkhard Bock, Bremen, and Monika Felsing, Bremen and Oberglen, Germany. Narrator, Susan Eldridge, near Badenhausen, Connecticut, USA. Heinrich Lemke, Reinhard Jung, Ritterhude, Germany. Timeline, Ingo Behrens and Rolf Rollo Schmidt, Bremen, Germany. Christoph Tebbens and Stuttering Mother, Monika Felsing, Bremen, Germany. Immigration Officer and Father, Thoralf Dunkel, Bremen, Germany. Judge, Hans Ganten, Worpswede, Germany. Russian Jew, Erika Thies, Worpswede, Germany. Interpreter, Horst Rasch, Worpswede, Germany. Innkeeper's Wife, Crying Mother and American Woman, Regina Dietzold, Bremen, Germany. Klezmer Improvisation, Yale Strom, San Diego, USA, and Clive Ford, Edna Eversmeyer, Till Eversmeyer and David Hodgkinson of the Klezmer Group, Kladatje. Ortrud Staude, Burkhard Bock of Paradogma, and Thomas Stapke at a Klezmer workshop taught by Yale Strom in March 2019 in Bremen, Germany.
Copyright in Connecticut, United States, and in Bremen, Germany, 2023 and 2024. The Historical Society La Storia wishes to thank every volunteer who participated in this transatlantic project about migration, as well as everyone who performed the research and published information from which this was written. Our podcast consists of 6 parts. The original version is in German. the German historian Monika Felsing used AI for initial translations of her manuscript from German to English, which was then revised with help from Susan Eldridge, née Badenhausen. The English and German parts of the podcast are online in the United States at badmorgen.wordpress.com. That's badmorgen.wordpress.com. In Germany, you can find them at monikafelsing.de. That's monikafelsing.de. The manuscripts and bibliography will be available at a later date. If you would like to listen to them, please don't hesitate to contact us in Germany at mail@lastoria-bremen.de or in the United States at badmoregenealogy@gmail.com. Copyright in Connecticut, United States, and in Bremen, Germany, 2023 and 2024. Our next podcast will be Part 6, Welcome or Not Welcome? A Fearful Question, How the Conditions of Immigration to the United States Have Changed Since the Early 20th Century. Copyright, all rights reserved. Public performance only with permission from the Historical Society Lastoria, Bremen, Bremen, Germany, and Connecticut, USA. 2023 and 2024.